President Obama goes to Riyadh today, Tuesday, January 27th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia reaffirm their close ties, but a group of American human rights activists want the president to do more about a blogger sentenced to 1,000 lashes. They say they'll take on his punishment.
We ask the Saudi government, please, do not carry out any more lashing. And if you insist on carrying out the punishment, the full 1,000 lashes, we would each take 100 lashes.
Also today, who killed ex-Russian agent Alexander Litvinenko in London in 2006? And feeling sorry for ourselves here in the blizzard in Boston, we decided to call a friend in the Northwest Territories.
It's not too bad today. It's into the minus 40s, so pretty typical for Yellowknife.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. The final flakes of snow of this massive nor'easter winter storm are falling here in Boston. Skies still not clear, not unlike my understanding of not one but two murder conspiracies we'll tell you about on The World today. One in Argentina, a prosecutor looking into a bombing. The other, a Russian poisoned in London. We turn first, though, to solemn ceremonies today in Poland. World leaders and 300 Holocaust survivors gathered in a giant white tent enclosing the gates of what was the Auschwitz concentration camp. 70 years ago today, the camp was liberated by the Soviets, the Red Army. Auschwitz survivor Marian Turski will never forget first arriving in the summer of 1944.
The first day of my arrival to Auschwitz, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. But still, it was dark, but with the greatest impression, enormous, great fire getting out from chimneys. And then fences.
He was 18 when he stepped onto the platform at the Auschwitz-Birkenau railway station.
And then we started marching, and suddenly I noticed a sign in German, zur Sauna, to the bathroom. But it is not the bathroom, it would be the gas chamber. And imagine I soiled my pants. The real bathroom looked exactly the same shape as a crematorium and a gas chamber. And then they ordered us to undress, and then they started shaving us. Then they put a disinfection to delouse me. It was so burning, it was like a fire, and everybody was screaming and shouting, everybody but me, because I understood I am to live.
Turski did live, but more than 1 million people were killed there.
Every day was to survive among us. Everybody insists you get up and wash yourself in order to save your dignity. Every day was half an hour to talk, to teach languages among ourselves, to speak about politics. It was absurd, but nevertheless, just to move your brain, to save your dignity. And this was, I am sure that in my case, this was why I survived.
Holocaust survivor Marian Turski. There are fewer and fewer survivors alive, so we need to hear these stories while we can. One more story now. This one set in 1942. The place is Mechelen, Belgium, just outside of Brussels. Belgium was occupied by the Nazis in 42. 11-year-old Simon Granovsky was one of more than 1,500 Jews in a detention camp. On April 19th of that year, Granovsky, his mother and sister were put on a train bound for Auschwitz. The train had some 30 cars locked from the outside. No food, no water, very little light. A small group of Belgian resistance fighters, one Jew and two Catholics, used a red lamp to fool the train driver into stopping suddenly. Some deportees, Granovsky remembers, made a break for it.
And then I heard screams and yelling from the German guards, and then I heard shooting.
Eventually, the train continued. Granovsky remembers falling asleep in his mother's arms. When he awoke, he found that some of the young men in his wagon had forced open the door to the boxcar.
My mother led me up to the open door, and there, two or three people jumped off the train before me. And when it was my turn, my mother, she lowered me so that my feet were on the footstep just below the carriage. The noise was deafening. The last words I heard my mother say to me were, "Der Zug geht zu schnell." The train is going too fast. But then I felt the train slow down. I told my mother, "Now I can jump." She let me go, and I jumped off.
The train stopped again. Guards began shooting at the escapees. Granovsky hid and waited until the train started off again. He had no idea if his mother and sister had jumped or not. He started walking.
I felt surprisingly calm. I remember humming the song in the mood.
Eventually, after knocking on a few doors, Granovsky was delivered to a local policeman. That policeman went to the train station to figure out what was going on.
When he returned, he said to me, "I know everything. You were in the train with the Jews. You are safe and you must not be afraid. I am a good Belgian and I will not betray you."
That policeman gave Granovsky some new clothes and put him on a train to Brussels. Eventually, the young boy found some Catholic friends who told him his father was in hiding nearby. Granovsky stayed hidden until the liberation of Brussels a year later. His father died while in hiding from the Nazis. His mother and sister both died in Auschwitz. After the war, Granovsky became a lawyer. He still lives in Brussels. His story was recorded a few years ago by our friends at the BBC program Witness. And by the way, Granovsky's also been known to dabble in jazz piano. Here he is playing with a group in Brussels after the war. Not everyone will remember the Holocaust, even on Holocaust Remembrance Day. At 53, I have to get used to that. I suppose it's only natural that successive generations forget the significance, or don't know it, of an event that happened before they were born. On the other hand, we know what happens when we forget history. I was born in 1961, 16 years after the camps were liberated. But at a young age, the notion of bearing witness made an impression on me. In part, it's what made me want to be a journalist. I remember as a kid the books in our house by documentary photographers who were at various camps when their gates were opened to the emaciated bodies, near death, inside. I remember my social studies teacher in junior high showing us Alain René's Night in Fog. I didn't have to be there to bear witness to piles of bodies, lifeless, souls eliminated en masse, millions of personal histories erased. Sometimes journalists bear witness in the present, as history happens. Other times, we just need to be reminders of history that already happened. You can read a few more thoughts I have on this at PRI.org. Now to one of those murder conspiracy stories I mentioned earlier on The World. You remember Alexander Litvinenko, right? If not, here's the brief. Litvinenko was the former Russian spy who was poisoned in London in 2006. Before he died, he accused Vladimir Putin of ordering his murder. The Kremlin, of course, denies it. Today, the chairman of a court of inquiry in London said he'd seen enough evidence to provide a prima facie case that the Russian state was involved. The BBC's Richard Galpin was in the courtroom.
Essentially what happened, certainly the allegation, is that two former members of the Russian secret services, men called Andrei Lugovoy and Dmitry Kovtun, travelled from Moscow to London, and they were carrying a file of the highly radioactive and very, very poisonous material called polonium-210. They then held a meeting with Alexander Litvinenko in a hotel here in central London, actually very close to the American embassy, where it's alleged that they put the polonium, which is a fluid, into tea, which Alexander Litvinenko was drinking.
Now, if we're to believe the chairman of the inquiry, Robert Owen, he doesn't see this as just an attack on Litvinenko. He accuses Russia of a miniature nuclear attack on the whole city of London. Can you explain that?
Yes, that's right. I mean, he's saying the evidence that has been seen so far, secret intelligence evidence, which I think actually was seen when there was an attempt to have a proper inquest rather than inquiry, that there is a prima facie case that the Russian state was involved. But certainly he did quote from other sources saying that what had happened was like a miniature nuclear attack on the streets of London. It obviously caused huge alarm here in London that a radioactive substance had been used, and it obviously potentially could have been very dangerous for a large number of people. And indeed, several hundred people were checked for signs of radiation poisoning.
What would have been the motive for the Kremlin to want Litvinenko dead?
This is absolutely key question. And back in the late 1990s, Alexander Litvinenko, who was a fairly senior member of the FSB, the successor to the KGB, went public. They held this extraordinary news conference in Moscow with a number of other FSB agents. And they accused, said that there was a unit within the FSB which was planning assassinations, including of a senior Russian politician and oligarch who was very powerful at the time in the Kremlin. Litvinenko also went on to say that the FSB, alleging that it was riddled with corruption, and apparently he then held a meeting with the head of the FSB, who at that time was Vladimir Putin, who of course is now the Russian president. The result of that was that he was dismissed from the FSB and then put on trial. He was later acquitted of those, or several sets of charges, was facing another set, and then he and his family fled here to Britain, where they were granted a political asylum very quickly. But then here in London, he continued, I mean, a very, very vocal campaign of opposition to Vladimir Putin.
I mean, a lot of people have suggested the Kremlin was responsible for Litvinenko's death. Litvinenko said so himself. Why, then, is this inquiry starting only now, more than 8 years after his death?
Yeah, another very good question. It's essentially because initially, the British authorities had hoped to hold a trial, obviously. The police actually moved very quickly and within a matter of months had collected a whole dossier of evidence, which they handed over to prosecutors here, who announced that Dmitry Kovtun and Andrei Lugovoy should be charged and put on trial. However, the Russian government refused to extradite them, and they actually say there's a clause in their constitution which prohibits extradition of Russian citizens to stand trial in other countries. So the British government tried, they expelled Russian diplomats, and there was tit-for-tat expulsions, relations deteriorated, but nothing happened. And actually the British government, I remember speaking to British diplomats in Moscow at the time saying, well, we've tried, we're now going to park the Litvinenko affair and get on with actually building better trade relations, which is the priority with Russia. However, back in London, Marina Litvinenko, Alexander Litvinenko's widow, pushed and pushed for a proper investigation.
Yeah, and how did Marina Litvinenko look today?
Well, I think for her, this is obviously a huge moment. As she said, speaking to the BBC, she has been working for this for the past more than 8 years. What she wants is to hear, you know, a definitive account of who was responsible for the murder of her husband. It's taken a very long time. She's been extraordinarily patient with it, but she wants to have some kind of conclusion and therefore some kind of closure. Of course, she believes she knows who was responsible, and she wants that to be made public and be made known around the world.
That was the BBC's Richard Galpin speaking with me from London. Another Russian spy story coming up after the break. Stick with us. You're listening to The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Moscow calls it a provocation and the latest stage of an anti-Russia campaign. That tough talk today is in reference to the arrest of an alleged Russian spy in New York. In a complaint unsealed Monday, an employee at a Russian state-run bank is charged with trying to recruit sources and collect economic intelligence. Federal agents nabbed him yesterday at his office in Manhattan. Two other Russians are involved but had diplomatic immunity. Colm Lynch reports and blogs for Foreign Policy magazine. He says the operation centered around a New York-based Russian named Evgeny Buryakov.
Essentially, you know, this guy's job was to try and penetrate New York banking circles to pick up information about what impact the U.S. economic sanctions were having on Russia, try to figure out, for example, you know, what countries the U.S. might be looking at, who might face sanctions, what individuals was it looking at, information that would be of interest to Russian businesses, corporations, state corporations, individuals, all of that sort of thing.
From your understanding, how compromising is what they might have found?
There was not a great deal of evidence that they uncovered enormously valuable information. I mean, in my view, the thing that was really kind of stood out was the degree to which the FBI monitored every single step they had taken. They had penetrated the Russians in, you know, sort of intelligence headquarters in New York, the headquarters of the SVR, the former KGB. They were able to get access to their computers. They were all over these guys.
How was the FBI tracking them?
They had wiretaps. One of the interesting sort of strategies they used was, since they weren't talking much on the telephone, is they would figure out where they were going and they would find ways to monitor their conversations walking around in public. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the movie The Conversation with Gene Hackman back in the 1970s or 80s, but it was a similar kind of strategy where they would go out and they would find out where they were and they would bring out, I guess, they don't say what they use, but they would use, you know, listening devices and pick up their conversations when they were walking around in public.
Now, you and your colleague Elias Grohl wrote that the spy ring described in that federal complaint unsealed on Monday reads less like John le Carré and more like the Keystone Cops. Tell us more about that. And is that why the FBI caught these guys?
These agents, they're spending a lot of time like complaining about the fate of, you know, intelligence gathering. They're talking about how boring it is, how, you know, it's nothing like sort of being in a James Bond movie. You don't get to fly helicopters. You don't even get to, you know, the government doesn't even provide you with a fake passport when you go abroad. They also said that when they talk about collecting evidence through unconventional means, which is like using sleepers and that sort of things, that they were having more success in places like the Middle East and Asia than they had had in the United States. So they used this case back in 2010, the famous redheaded Russian spy Anna Chapman and nine others who were sort of basically just living like normal people in the United States and were, you know, supposed to gradually start collecting information about sort of political life and businesses in the U.S., but they never really collected anything of very much meaning.
It's been more than 20 years since the Cold War ended. Does this sort of story surprise you?
You certainly don't see a diminution of intelligence gathering on any side. The U.S., you know, we've been paying a lot of attention to NSA spying, not only the UN, but all over the world, British electronic snooping. And the Russians, you know, I mean, there have been several cases since the end of the Cold War where you've had Russian defections, you have had, you know, cases uncovered.
Colm Lynch, who reports and blogs about the United Nations for Foreign Policy magazine. Always good to speak with you. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for having me, Marco.
No doubt any Russian spy worth his or her salt would try to seem as American as possible, scarfing down apple pie, and there's one suggestion. Or how about the quintessential American dessert, chocolate chip cookies? You might not know that the cookie was born here, the chocolate chip cookie, that is, in Massachusetts. It was invented by Ruth Graves Wakefield in 1938 and quickly became a national sensation. We all know exactly what a chocolate chip cookie is supposed to taste like. And according to Alina Simone, that is exactly the problem.
Walk into Beaner Bar in Brooklyn and you'll find a jar of chocolate chip cookies on the counter with a sign taped to it that says, "The best cookie in the world." Yeah, whatever. That's what I thought when I first tried this cookie. Until its spicy, crazy, chocolate, cardamom-drenched sea salt goodness hijacked my face. And I realized this literally was the best cookie I'd ever had.
How cool, a spicy cookie.
Beaner Bar regular Mike Caprio definitely agrees.
I remember the first time I bit into it, man, the flavors were just so intense. The cardamom, like, immediately came over me. And then, you know, the finish with the salt and just the chocolatey goodness all wrapped around it. Yeah, it's a heck of a cookie.
And you'll only find it here at Beaner Bar, a fitting home for a cookie spicy enough to bite you back.
I feel like we spice every everything we can. We definitely put cayenne even in our teas sometimes, so we're very pro-spice.
Lori Ehrlitz-Pagden is one of Beaner Bar's three owners, all of whom are Mexican-American.
It's definitely, you know, the feel that we were all missing, the Mexican element, Day of the Dead. We do the celebrations, and even from our childhood, the Mexican chocolate is always spicy. So you hand grind the chocolate, and there's like a romance to it.
And there's romance to the cookie, too, which is made by one guy, a guy who makes just one cookie. His name's Armando Rafael Mutella.
People often ask me, well, isn't there another cookie or, like, you know, any kind of bar or something, any other pastries? I'm like, no.
Armando's a food photographer, but he grew up spending summers working at his aunt's bakery in Portugal. The cookie is a sideline, but one he's taken to an extreme.
It took me about a year to perfect the recipe. And I think that's part because I'm just anal, retentive.
It started with the simple idea of cayenne and chocolate.
So then I started researching cookie recipes and kept researching and testing tons of recipes and altering the recipes and changing all the ratios.
Until he got that perfect balance between the cayenne and the cardamom, the sugar and the sea salt. It's all about the ratios.
A friend of mine, one of my best friends, she's a chef, and she's taken the cookie, and her other, like, chef friends have tried to figure out the recipe. Because you can try to do it. And the portions, the ratios, you're just not going to get it.
And chances are you're not going to get the cookie either, unless you're in Greenpoint. Which is why every month, Armando and I do a handoff in the lobby of my apartment building. Money for cookies in a brown paper bag, as my neighbors look suspiciously on. I've said to Armando, come on, this could be the Cronut of Brooklyn. Why don't you make more cookies and sell them in more places to more people like me? He shrugs it off, claims he's not a good self-promoter. I get it. But I also suspect he derives a weird sort of glee from being one guy with one cookie sold at only one cafe.
Just one good cookie. That's all it is. That's all you're getting.
As for Lori, she's not complaining about Beaner Bar's monopoly over the best cookie in the world. Nor is she waiting for Armando to bust out with, say, a Tabasco oatmeal cookie or some other spicy confection to complement their Mexican mocha.
He doesn't need to do another cookie because probably the other cookie would not. I'd feel sorry for the other cookie. And that's what it would be called, the other cookie.
For the world, from Brooklyn, this is Alina Simone.
Still to come on The World, taking the Folsom Prison Blues and handing the microphone over to the inmates. Our story from Malawi and news headlines coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on The World, it's a dog's life up in the Northwest Territories, even when it's 40 below.
I have a little Cocker Spaniel, and she loves it up here. We have our good winter jacket for her. You need little boots on them so their feet don't get too cold. So all the dogs seem to love getting outside and running across our frozen lakes and all that fun stuff.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with support from Lumosity.com. Brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. You can learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. President Obama made a brief visit to Saudi Arabia today. The high-level delegation paid respects following the death of King Abdullah. The quick visit was also aimed at building ties with the new monarch, King Salman. The BBC's security correspondent, Frank Gardner, was at the event today and breaks things down for us.
This is, although brief, a very important summit between King Salman, the newly appointed king of Saudi Arabia following the death of Abdullah, and President Obama, who's spending only a few hours in the country, but bringing with him a delegation of 30 people, including his wife, a number of previous secretaries of state. He's bringing the head of the CIA, John Brennan. This is a very important strategic ally for Saudi Arabia, but there are concerns and strains beneath the surface. The most important one, in my view, is that they differ on the necessity of getting rid of President Bashar al-Assad of Syria. The Saudis are going to say privately, look, you're never going to be able to deal with ISIS while Bashar al-Assad is in power.
There's another elephant in the room as well, human rights. I'm talking, among other things, about the blogger sentenced in Saudi Arabia to 10 years in prison and 1,000 lashes. 50 of those lashes have been carried out. What Raif Badawi did was write on his website, Free Saudi Liberals, as a way to stir debate about religion and politics. Certainly President Obama was aware of the case. He told CNN before his trip that even when the U.S. has to talk with Saudi Arabia about the immediate concern of terrorism, human rights is still on the agenda. Difficult to know whether Obama today brought up with the royal family the idea put forward in a letter by Professor Robert George. He teaches philosophy of law at Princeton. He's also vice chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Can you tell us, Professor, what you said in your letter to the Saudi ambassador to the U.S.? You wrote this letter prior to the death of King Abdullah, correct?
Yes, that's correct. And I was joined in the letter by six of my colleagues on the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, although we did not write in our official capacities. Each of us is independently a human rights, religious freedom advocate, activist, and we were writing in our individual capacities. What the letter said was simply this: what is being done, the abusive punishment of Raif Badawi, really truly amounting to torture that might result in his death, 1,000 lashes, is not only inhumane, it's deeply unjust and contrary to international agreements that the Saudi government has itself signed on to. So we ask the Saudi government, please remit the punishment of Raif Badawi. Do not carry out any more lashing. And if you will not heed our words on this, if you insist on carrying out the punishment, the full 1,000 lashes, then each of us asks, we would each take 100 lashes. To spare him at least that portion of his punishment.
Is this a symbolic gesture? I doubt it. Or would you and the signatories actually take the lashes?
You don't make a request or an offer like this unless you mean it.
Yeah.
Now, will the Saudis accept the offer? I don't think so. It would be profoundly embarrassing to them to do this. But we want to embarrass them about what they're doing to Raif Badawi.
Is there anything in Saudi law or even Quranic law that suggests a volunteer can take the punishment for a convicted person?
I don't know. I'm certainly not an expert on Quranic law. And of course, there are many different interpretations of the Quran. The Saudi interpretation of the Quran generally is quite different from interpretations offered by other schools of thought within Islam. The Saudi regime follows a fundamentalist school of Islam and Quranic interpretation. It's called Wahhabism. I dare say that most American Muslims, for example, whether they are Sunnis or Shiites, would reject that kind of fundamentalism.
I noticed that you begin your letter to the Saudi ambassador kind of complimenting the Saudi government for going to Paris to march in the Solidarity March after the Charlie Hebdo shootings. I suppose you see that as evidence that if they support freedom of speech in one case, they have to support it in all cases?
That's right. I mean, it's hypocritical of them to march in solidarity with the victims of terrorism and persecution for speaking their minds in Europe, and then to practice that same abuse of people for speaking their minds, for exercising their religious freedom, their freedom of speech in their own country. I would also add, Marco, that the Saudis seem to care about their international reputation. We have learned from past experience, some of which involve behind-the-scenes negotiating. Saudis really do believe it's in their interest for the world to think well of them, or at least not think too badly of them. So we're hoping that by elevating the profile of the Badawi case and of the grotesque abuse of this prisoner of conscience, that will cause the Saudis, perhaps with some face-saving device, to say, look, okay, he's had 50 lashes. Well, we're going to, as a matter of mercy, remit this punishment. We'll take what we can get. I don't care what story they tell themselves or try to tell the world. We want the abuse of this man to stop.
You said that you haven't heard any reaction from the Saudi government to this letter that you signed with the others. What about the U.S. government? And do you think Obama brought it up in his consultations with the royal family?
I pray that he did or that he does. I, of course, have no way of knowing whether that is or was his intention, but he sure should be doing it. Now, I know he is there in the aftermath of the death of the king. There are diplomatic niceties that have to be observed, but we have leverage. We are an important ally for them, just as they are important to us.
Robert George, Vice Chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Thanks very much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure, Marco. Thank you very much.
If you're waiting anxiously for the next season of House of Cards on Netflix, you can just follow the news out of Argentina and have yourselves a real-life version of it. A prosecutor there named Alberto Nisman reportedly commits suicide after accusing high-ranking officials, including President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, of shady dealing. It all centered around Nisman's investigation into the 1994 bombing of a Jewish center in Buenos Aires that killed 85 people. Those accused strongly deny the allegations, but the story just keeps getting weirder every day. To make some sense of the latest twist, I've got my BBC colleague in Buenos Aires, Veronica Smink, with me. So first, President Fernandez says the death of Nisman was a suicide. Then she says, no, it was more likely a homicide. Now she's trying to disband the whole Argentine intelligence agency. Can you just tell us what this intelligence agency is? What is its history?
Yeah, well, what the president is saying is actually that Nisman's death is a plot or was a plot to try to overthrow her government or to affect her government. And she is accusing agents or rogue agents from this infamous intelligence agency, which the Argentines know as CIDE. Basically, this is an agency created in the 1940s. According to some historians, it was originally a civilian agency created by a former strongman, General Perón, in Argentina, with the intention of arranging the transportation of Nazis to Argentina. But it then became a formal like spying agency. And I think the darkest period of the CIDE was during the latest Argentine military regime in the 70s, when the CIDE was well known for spying on anyone considered subversive.
What do everyday Argentines think of CIDE, especially for those who lived through the 70s?
Anybody who talks about CIDE usually refers to it as a very seedy, dark organization, because since the return to democracy in 1983, it's quite well known that a lot of governments used the CIDE for spying operations on opposition politicians, on journalists, on judges, prosecutors. So basically, the CIDE is considered like the power behind the power.
How is President Fernandez, though, connecting this intelligence agency to the death of Prosecutor Nisman?
Well, she's saying that Nisman's accusation, when Nisman accused the president a few days before his death of being behind a plot to cover up Iran's alleged involvement in the bombing, she says that all that was actually fabricated by a former spy who was trying to affect the government. That's what she said immediately after the news of Nisman's death. A couple of days later, she said she actually believed that the operation against her government was not actually the accusation that Nisman had presented, but actually Nisman's death. But last night she actually spoke to the Argentine public and said that, you know, the Nisman situation called for a complete overhaul of the intelligence services.
So if CIDE is the power behind the power, can President Fernandez actually shut them down?
Well, this is the thing that surprised a lot of people. Some people thought that, you know, because of the power that they got during the last years, that CIDE agents might have so much information even on the president herself that she would not, you know, have the courage to do this. So this is why supporters of the president think that this is quite a courageous thing to have done, because, you know, the CIDE is well known for their operations. And of course, what the president is suggesting is that, again, this is an operation against her.
So finally, Veronica, where does this actually leave the investigation into how Prosecutor Alberto Nisman died?
Yes, well, the president and the public are having this debate about the alleged role of the intelligence services in the death of Nisman. The prosecutors are still investigating, and the investigation still has no clear leads as to what happened the night on the 8th of the 18th when Nisman died. At first, everything indicated a suicide, but they're still investigating this as a doubtful death. And the only person considered a suspect right now is the last person who allegedly saw Nisman alive and who gave him the gun that eventually ended his life.
My colleague at the BBC in Buenos Aires, Veronica Smink, thank you for the update, Veronica.
Thank you, Marco.
The weather is, of course, a huge story today here in the Northeast. Some of us have piles of snow, some don't. I skied to work today, so did a few of my colleagues. Some snowshoed in. Outside, it's just white. Boston is shut down today. But while a lot of us were whining about the cold and wind, my colleague Andrea Crossan was reminding us, hey, suck it up, at least you don't live in Canada. To show us how tough Canadians are, she called a friend to check on weather conditions there, and she found someone in a place that would really make us feel like weenies, Christy Kleiman-Haga, a meteorologist with CBC North in the Canadian city of Yellowknife in the Northwest Territories. I'm already freezing just hearing those words.
CBC, this is Christy.
Hey, Christy, it's Andrea.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you doing today?
Good.
So, Christy, I just wanted to ask you, what's the weather like in Yellowknife today?
It's not too bad today. It's into the minus 40s, so pretty typical for Yellowknife in Fahrenheit. So, yeah, looking at wind chills in Yellowknife of about minus 50
Minus
Fahrenheit.
50 Fahrenheit. Wow.
Yeah,
okay.
So it's a little nippy, but it's gorgeous sunshine, and it's kind of funny when we get this kind of weather. Everyone seems happy to at least see the sun because the days are so short.
Okay, well, you've made me feel much better about my situation here in Boston. I had to walk into work today, which isn't that far from me, but some of my other colleagues had to ski and walk really long distances to get in because Boston has come to a complete standstill because of the snow here. What is it like up there when it's that cold? What's the biggest concern?
When we get to this cold, it's funny how the cars don't want to start. You have to have a battery blanket on your vehicle and a block heater and have it plugged in for a couple hours at least to get it even just going. And then once you get it started, you have to let it run for about 15 minutes so that it doesn't just get destroyed when you start turning the wheel when it's all frozen. So it's kind of funny. It's a longer process to get into work, but it's also funny how it seems like business as usual. It's kind of what you do in the winter.
Do you sit around when you see these news reports about us and laugh?
We sometimes have a little bit of chuckle, but at the same time, we kind of get it. I mean, we don't see that heavy snow that you see in the south because it's so wet. When we get snow up here, it's pretty light and fluffy, and even if we get maybe 10 inches of it, it's not a big of a deal because it's not so slippery as what you guys get. So as much as we think, oh, that's not too bad, I do get it. I understand how it can be such a difficult thing to deal with, especially when you don't see it that often.
So this morning, like every morning, I have to walk my dog before I come in. I have a greyhound. He is super skinny. So I have a dog in a sweater. Could he even survive in Yellowknife?
Well, it's kind of funny you say so because my dog, I have a little Cocker Spaniel, and she loves it up here. We have our good winter jacket for her, so if you go outside for a nice long walk, you put the big winter jacket. You need little boots on them so their feet don't get too cold. So it would be, I think, a little bit of an adjustment. He might need to pack on a few pounds to keep himself warm, but all the dogs seem to love the cold weather and love getting outside and running across our frozen lakes and all that fun stuff.
How long can you stay outside when it's minus 40 or minus 50 Fahrenheit outside?
Well, it's a lot more difficult. It's definitely quicker walks outside when it's this cold. Usually in the winter, we're sitting around about minus 16 to minus 20 as like a nice day. So we do get these very cold days, which are very typical. But when it's nicer, about minus 14 Fahrenheit, we can get outside for hours and put our jackets on and go. But when it gets this cold, it is a little tricky. You basically bundle up as much as you can. The bigger you look, the better it is. And you just kind of embrace it because otherwise it's a very long winter up here. You kind of have to get outside to enjoy it a little.
Bigger is better. Thank you so much for the advice, Christy. And take care and stay warm in Yellowknife.
Thank you. Enjoy the snow.
That was the world's one woman Canada desk, Andrea Crossan, chatting with her friend, CBC North meteorologist Christy Kleiman-Haga, bringing us in the Northeast U.S. down to size. Christy is in Yellowknife in the Northwest Territories. Hey, it was an adventure getting to work today here in Boston. It's not Yellowknife, but we've got a small selection of our snowy commute adventures. If you want to see my commute on skis and Andrea and the rest of the team walking in a winter wonderland, visit us on our Instagram page and on our Facebook page, PRI The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings and legal plans featuring attorney contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. prisons and music, from prison work songs to Johnny Cash. There have been some great recordings of Johnny Cash, his gigs at San Quentin and Folsom back in the 60s. There was also Eddie Palmieri and his funk outfit Harlem River Drive. They turned out an incredible recording at Sing Sing. Recordings of inmates making music, though, is a different proposition, but it exists in a new recording produced at the Zomba Maximum Security Prison. It's in Malawi.
I smoke the jamba, I smoke them no more. I kill the people, I kill them no more. Oh, we drink the beer, we drink them no more. It was a great day when I was born again.
That's one song from the Zomba prison project called I Kill No More by inmate Josephine Banda. Ian Brennan is the producer of the Zomba prison project. So you recorded both women and men, obviously. Take us into this prison, the Zomba Maximum Security Prison. I mean, I guess the name suggests it holds hardcore criminals. Describe it.
Well, I mean, it's a prison that was built in the 19th century to house a couple of hundred people, and it currently holds over 2,000. It's a pretty rough environment, not only for the prisoners, but also for the individuals that work there.
Are men and women in kind of the same cell blocks? Not the same cells, probably, but do they find themselves together?
The women's area is separate from the men's, and it holds about 50 to 100 people. The women make up a small percentage of the prisoner population there. But it's quite a difficult area in that they are locked down from before sundown till sunrise and are packed together in these tiny rooms. There's a lot of problems there with rats, and they are also there with some of them with their children. So there's quite a few infants and smaller children that are part of the prison population.
Wow, that's extraordinary. So eight times the kind of intended prison population that's there today. What kind of crimes did these people typically commit to end up in this place? It's just crammed full of inmates.
Well, it ranges from, you know, theft, burglary, to murder and assault. Unfortunately, many people are also there for charges of witchcraft. And many people are there for homosexuality as well, or related charges. And many of them remain there for long periods simply for lack of representation.
The subtitle of Zomba Prison Project is I Have No Everything Here. And it's kind of like a lot of other song titles on the album. Give Me Back My Child. I See the Whole World Dying of AIDS. Don't Hate Me. They tell stories. Ian Brennan, did you find a lot of the prisoners at Zomba were actually itching to tell their story? I mean, a lot of these are confessional type songs.
You know, I think that in a sense that they were, and we had a very interesting experience on the women's side, and that was that they have no instruments on the women's side, and they claim to not be songwriters. But we had brought a guitar, and finally, after not that much encouragement, but, you know, a little, you know, continuing to claim that they did not write, one of the women stepped forward and played one of her songs, and it was just stunning. And once she did that, it was like the floodgates had broken open. And in fact, two of those songs are on the record. It's by a woman, Gladys, who has one of the more original voices I've ever heard in my life.
You know, Ian, one thing that I found really striking on this album is that musically, it feels like there's a microphone just eavesdropping on these inmates singing. In other places, like when Gladys Zinamo sings, there's some real talent, and it's a magical moment. Were you trying to provide a document of music in the prison, or was this, do you think, a launchpad for like a career in music for these inmates when they get out?
Only time can tell what would result from it, but certainly I believe that the story is important. I believe that the politics are important, but I also firmly believe that the music has to stand on its own and the music has to come first. And what interests me are songs and voices and intimacy, which I think you so astutely just referred to. I'm also extremely interested in hearing voices that are not influenced by other voices, that really arise organically from someone's life and experiences. And I think Gladys's voice is such a stunning example of that. It's not for everybody, but again, I don't know if I've ever heard a voice as unique as hers.
Kundilanda juma zakala benti moyo kundilanda juma zakala benti moyo kundilanda juma zakala benti moyo kundilanda juma zakala benti moyo.
I gather three of the women on the Zomba Prison Project album have since been released, since you recorded it. What is the fate of many of the other prisoners? And also, well, is Gladys one of those three?
No, she is not. We were able to gain the release of three of the prisoners following being there to record, and when we were very heartened by that. So we began to pursue three more cases, and those have gone more expectedly or predictably from what we thought would happen, and that is that it's just dragged on now for more than a year, those three cases, and we don't know what the ultimate fate will be. And that's largely bureaucratic, files being lost, files, holidays and shutdowns and strikes and in the courts and that sort of thing. So the aspiration is that we'll be able to continue and maybe inspire other people also to contribute to getting some of these cases heard, where the people are truly there because they have not even had their process yet. Gladys is due to be released relatively soon, so hopefully that will happen. Her sentence is due to run out relatively soon, like in the next year or so.
Ian Brennan, producer of the Zomba Prison Project, I Have No Everything. Thank you very much for speaking with us, and thanks for taking the microphone to this very unknown part of the world.
It's my honor. Thank you.
You can watch a mini-documentary of the men and women inmates from the Zomba Prison Project at PRI.org. That's our program for today. We're about to venture out into the snow. You stay safe if you're in it. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, see you back here tomorrow.
Bonongo gaja gugoma, bonongwe, bonongo gaja gugoma, bonongwe, bonongo gaja gugoma. Azima iya lelo kutaka taka mamuna aligoni. Azima iya lelo kutaka taka mamuna aligoni. Ena kumabeda kumakanga kukawoda mbatata mamuna aligoni. Ena kumabeda kulizulu kukawoda.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor, the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, the Annenberg Foundation, advancing a better tomorrow through visionary leadership today, annenbergfoundation.org, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.